Have you heard of Olivia? The travel company for lesbians and LGBTQ plus women? You know what they say. Life is better in flip-flops. And when you're a lesbian or LGBTQ plus woman, you want to be able to go on vacation, put your feet up, and be your unique self. Olivia Travel creates full takeovers of their cruise, resort, riverboat, and adventure vacations, so you can kiss who you want to kiss without a care in the world. You've never felt relaxation like this. Discover Olivia for yourself at olivia.com or through the link in our show notes and save $100 on your next Olivia booking when you use promo code CRUISING.
She always wore the same thing. She always wore loafers, a skirt, usually a white short sleeve, like shirt with a collar, with a pocket on the front, because in the pocket, she'd stick her cigarettes.
This is Ellen Frail. She's talking about her one-time girlfriend and business partner, Alice Brady.
Most people call her Brady.
Brady owned lesbian bars in New Orleans between 1952 and 1978, and she was an unforgettable character.
If you saw her today, you would say, oh, look at this big old dyke, you know. That's how she kind of looked. She was kind of chubby and real short hair, very, very gruff. And she'd walk in, you know, she's kind of gruff, and she'd say, hey, motherfucker. You know, how are you, or whatever. And that's just the way she is. That's the way everybody expected her to be.
Ellen remembers once encouraging Alice to be a bit warmer around the bar.
Instead of when you walk in the bar and you just, you know, say, oh, motherfucker, why don't you try walking into the bar and just saying, hey, how you doing? How's your day going? What you been up to and all that? And she said, really? And I said, yeah, come on, let's try it. So she did. All right. She started going into the bar and being very pleasant. You know, how you doing? It's good to see you. And, you know, just normal conversation. No cussing, no nothing. And I think it was about maybe 2 weeks. I was inundated with complaints from people calling me up saying, we don't like Alice like that. We like her old self, you know, and everything. What are you doing to her or whatever? And so that night, I think I just turned to her and said, hey, Alice, go back to your old self. Go back, and when you walk in, just say, oh, motherfucker, get out of my face.
Sure, people loved Alice for her attitude, but she was much more than her tough exterior.
Underneath that was probably the softest soul and most generous soul you would ever, ever find. Too generous to a fault. She probably would have ended up being very, very wealthy, which she did not, because she gave it all away. People would come in there all the time and say, Alice, I can't pay my rent. So just reach in her pocket and give it to her. All that gruffness and all the MFs in there, that was just a persona. That was just a facade. You know, that was the Alice Brady facade. But underneath it, she was just completely, completely different.
This is Cruising, a podcast about the last lesbian bars in the U.S. My name is Sarah Gabrielli, and I'm traveling to each one of them with my two friends and chosen family. This episode, we're taking you back in time to Alice Brady's.
But I think a case could be made that Alice Brady was the first lesbian bar owner.
This is Frank Perez, a New Orleans queer historian.
In the popular imagination of those still alive and are that old to remember, yeah, first known, I would go with that.
To be clear, he means the first known owner of a lesbian bar in New Orleans. The city has a rich history of bar owners who happened to be lesbians, but they didn't necessarily own lesbian bars. One of the most prominent was a woman known as Miss Dixie.
She owned a very, very popular gay bar called Miss Dixie's Bar of Music. She didn't advertise it or market it as a gay bar, but that's what it was.
Although she herself was a lesbian, when Miss Dixie opened her bar in 1938, she didn't intend for it to be gay. Nevertheless, she must have cultivated a welcoming environment because it quickly became a place where LGBT folks of all genders rubbed shoulders with straight people, tourists, and even celebrities and politicians. And then there was Mary Collins, who opened Café Lafitte in 1933. Also a lesbian, Mary Collins drew in some lesbian patrons who mingled with the larger crowd of gay men and straight folks. Café Lafitte still stands today, though in a different location, and claims to be the oldest continuously operating gay bar in the United States, as does Oakland, California's The White Horse Inn, which also opened in 1933. Alice Brady herself would eventually cross paths with Mary Collins, but that was over a decade later, because in 1933, Alice would have been only 6 years old. She was born in Birmingham, Alabama, in July of 1927, to parents Alice Pickles Brady and Wilson D. Brady. She had one sibling, an older sister named Maud Eddie Wynn, and their father, Wilson, found work traveling with the railroad before eventually opening a boarding house and settling his family in Pineville, Louisiana.
Which is a real small town right outside of Alexandria, Louisiana. They were very poor.
Some of what we know about Alice's early life and family comes from Riley, Alice's nephew, and his wife Lois, who both had a special bond with their Aunt Alice. They didn't want to be recorded for the podcast, but were kind enough to spend a couple of hours on the phone chatting about her life.
Chrysler now bring you Major Edward Bowes and his original Amateur Hour.
As a young girl, Alice entered a radio talent show called Major Bowes Amateur Hour. And for her region, she won.
She had a beautiful voice. It was, I think, in New York, I believe. It was either in Chicago or New York. But she was too poor to go. She had no clothes, the family didn't have any money. And at that time, apparently, you know, there wasn't any, like nowadays, they'd pay your way and all that. It wasn't that kind of a deal. And like she used to laugh, she said, all I had was my overalls. I'd have to go up there and sing in my overalls. You know, they were farmers. So she didn't get to go. But I always found that very interesting on, you know, what would have maybe happened because she did have an absolutely beautiful singing voice.
Instead, at around 18 years old, Alice made her way to New Orleans.
She decided, you know, that she was leaving home, which was only a town, maybe of 10,000 people, and she came to New Orleans. And she didn't really have any money or anything. In fact, as she said, she and a good friend of hers, they used to sleep on the benches in Jackson Square and just get newspapers cover up for warmth.
As the story goes, Alice arrived in New Orleans with one suitcase in hand. It would have been around 1945, give or take a year. And right away, she met a woman who would become her lifelong friend. The woman's name was Dorothy Wilde, but everyone called her Torchy.
Torchy, I think, is like one of the first people that Alice met when Alice got off the bus to come to New Orleans when she was, what, 18 or 19 years old. And they were friends from then on. She was just like always a fixture, kind of, you'd say, in Alice's life. They were just always friends.
It's this friendship with Torchy that first got Alice into the local bar scene, which then turned into a job as a bartender.
She got into the bar, you know, being a bartender, and she really, really enjoyed it. It was really, she was made for that type of life, I think. People were drawn to her. She had a certain way about her. And she could hold her best conversation-wise with, you know, professors on down to street cleaners. It didn't matter, you know. She could hold her own. She had a personality that was just dynamite.
Some of Alice's most loyal patrons were strippers from the French Quarter, whom she'd met through Torchy. She'd become rather close with them.
You'll find that a good portion of your strippers are gay. So they more or less adopted Alice Brady when she was at the Masquerade.
The Masquerade was Brady's first bar, which she owned for a short while, beginning in 1952.
One of my favorite stories was it was time to pay her alcohol license, but it was expensive. And she didn't have the money. And one of the top strippers on Bourbon Street called her and said, Alice, could we borrow your bar tomorrow night? We're having this party for the, you know, for these dudes, and we'd like to borrow your bar. And she said, sure. And so she let him have the bar for that whole night. Well, the next day when she walked in, she went into her office, and sitting on top of her desk was a cigar box. And when she opened it up, it was all this money, more than enough money to pay her alcohol license. What the strippers had done, had all gotten together, and they brought all their Johns down there to the Masquerade. That was their intention the whole time. They knew that she financially couldn't get the license, and they didn't want her to close. They wanted her to stay in business. And so they just, with their little group, got together and said, this is what we're going to do. Just because they loved her and everything, they did that for one night. And they raised all that money that kept her in business for a whole nother year. That's how much people cared about her.
From there, Alice went to work for another well-known female bar owner at a spot called the Galley House.
Galley House was very famous at that time. It was run by Mary Collins. And Alice Brady was like Mary Collins' right-hand man. It was predominantly a men's bar. But very, very famous. But like I said, basically men. They used to jokingly refer to it as the wrinkle room.
Because most of the men that went there were of a certain age.
Mary Collins herself was just a character, you know, but very well known. And she was very popular, like with all the politicians and stuff. She had a big old dinner party for all the mucky mucks and all the, you know, politicians and all the mayors and, you know, all kinds of, just a lot of wealth in New Orleans, you know, and it was supposed to be a cocktail and dinner party, and in about the middle of it, she walked out and she had an egg in her hand, and she took the egg and she smashed it in her head. And she said, gentlemen, dinner is served. That's the kind she was.
But it was Alice, technically just Mary's bartender at the time, that would become the face of the Galley House.
She wasn't a financial partner, but you might as well say she was a partner. You know, Mary Collins depended on her totally and paid her well. All the guys would come, hey, come on, we're going to go see Alice. It was the attitude, you know, come on, let's go see Alice. And she brought in lots and lots of business. And so she always had a good number of clientele following her, whether it be gay men or gay women. Wherever Brady was going to be, people were going. You know, that's just the way that it was.
And so, in the late 50s, they followed Alice to another bar of her own, this time with her name on it.
Brady's Bar, which was on Ursuline Street in the French Quarter, across the street from the convent. She had a backer, and it was an oldish man, and he took a liking to Alice. And so he just backed her for to get started. Anyway, it was a very small bar, but there was no place better than that bar.
Especially considering the world outside of the bar was a scary place for gay women of the time.
Well, the most important thing to know about queer culture in the 1950s and 60s is that it was a very hostile environment, and therefore it was very difficult to be out. In the 1950s, the city actually adopted what they called, and I quote, a climate of hostility. And the mayor at that time was a man by the name of Delepsis Morrison, who was pretty homophobic, and he appointed a committee that was called the Committee on the Problem of Sex Deviants. And this committee's sole purpose for existing was to harass queer people and drive them out of the French Quarter. Obviously, that did not work. But they, the way they would do their work is they would harass bars. They would, you know, cite the owners or the managers on and the people who work there on really stupid things like, you know, if you were a guy bartender and you wore an earring, you know, that was enough to be suspect. You know, if your liquor license didn't have all the T's crossed and the I's dotted, they would harass. They would look for any excuse to harass you.
Especially with women. If women didn't have what they considered three pieces of feminine clothing on them, they would arrest them for impersonating a man.
This is Diane DiMaselli, another New Orleans lesbian bar owner.
They would arrest you. They would harass you. They would do all those things. You were not safe.
And then there was life inside Alice Brady's.
She really took care of her people. When you went to Brady's bar, you knew you were safe. You didn't have to worry about it getting raided or anything else. A lot of it was just her becoming friends with the powers that be. And a lot of that came from her working at the Galley House, because the Galley House was the place to go, you know, and a lot of men with money and power and everything else. She became good friends with a lot of people who could assure her that her bars were going to be safe.
She was always very cautious, you know, at the door, watching, making sure everything was okay.
Alice's personal connections and her physical presence at the bar seems to have gone a long way in protecting her customers. She was very diligent about making sure her patrons weren't behaving in a way that could get them in any trouble.
She would kind of rule over her bar with a baseball bat. And if two women got a little too touchy-feely, or she didn't know what their hands were doing below the bar, that bat would come down, because that was enough to get you not only arrested, but shut down.
Ellen recalls a lot of very particular rules at Brady's.
Her bar was famous for being no druggies. She just didn't tolerate that. You know, you could cuss and smoke and drink all you want, but no druggies. Of course, I mean, people smoke, go outside and smoke their grass or whatever. She wouldn't know, but basically you would say a drug-free bar.
This was just the beginning of the cautionary rules that Alice Brady enforced.
Girls were not allowed in the bars without a skirt on.
At least not after 5 o'clock.
So like at 5 o'clock, the girls had to go home and change into a skirt or a dress. I mean, think about that. The customers had to go, the women customers had to go home at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and put a skirt on. Think about that. I mean, that's terrible. And of course, you weren't allowed to dance or touch each other or anything like that. Oh, no, 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 no. Dancing was a no-no. No women dancing. That would be something that, yes, the cops would grab you for. So of course, it was a joke. Brady says, no dancing, you know.
But behind her iron fist, Alice was a total softie, not to mention insanely generous.
She was one of these kind that if you got in there and you were too drunk, she just would call a cab and send you home. And she'd say, come back tomorrow. And she'd pay the cab and all that. If they went out and they got in trouble and for whatever reason got pulled into the police station, she'd go down there and pay whatever she had to pay to get them out. She was just that kind of a person. Brady was very famous for giving you more than a fair drink. On her mixed drinks, it was always a jigger and a half. That's outrageous. You're not going to find any bar in today's time. Most bars nowadays only give you about, if you're lucky, 7/8 of a jigger. She really took care of her people. And so, of course, they absolutely adored her.
Ellen herself first went to Brady's in late 1967. She was 22 at the time, and it was her first ever gay bar.
Sometimes, you know, at late at night, she'd say, okay, lock the door. You know, might be 1 o'clock in the morning. Okay, lock the door. So we'd lock the door and she'd sing. We'd all sit in there and drink and she'd sing. That was a real treat. Because when I tell you she could sing, she could flat sing. Her voice was deep, of course. And of course, she would sing, you know, mostly ballads or whatever. I mean, she was quite a music aficionado.
Eventually, Brady's would move into a bigger space.
The one everybody remembers was on North Rampart at the corner of St. Peter. And that was well known as a lesbian bar.
And it was a double door. And you went in. It was a fairly nice sized room. And the bar was along that back side of that room. Then on the other side was the jukebox. At that time, you know, you had your big jukeboxes.
In this new space, now in the 1970s, it was becoming more and more acceptable for women to dance with each other in the bars around town.
And of course, the girls had been on her. Oh, come on, Brady, let us dance or whatever. Come on, you know, whatever and all that. A bit on her about it. And then finally she got to the point where she realized, yeah, it would be okay, that everybody would be safe. Her main concern was the safety of her customers.
Ellen will never forget the day that dancing was first permitted at Brady's.
Everybody was laughing and cutting up, and somebody got up on the top of the bar and said, we have a major announcement. Everybody said, what? Alice Brady says you can dance. So I was like a big celebration. Oh, yay, we can dance. You know, that was like a big celebration. So from then on, you know, you could dance.
Before Ellen and Alice ever dated, they were friends. They really got close when Ellen started her own business and Alice became somewhat of a mentor to her.
Just a small, like, corner restaurant with a close friend of mine. I mean, you know, a newly starting restaurant is tough, especially since neither one of us knew a damn thing about the restaurant business. She would come in and she just helped us as we were going along. I remember one night we had a fair crowd. It was around dinner and I had to run out to go get something. I don't even remember what. And when I came back, every chair in the place was full. The place was packed. And I walked in and I said, what in the hell happened? And she said, Alice Brady. And I said, what? Well, Alice was at the bar and she said, okay, everybody, it's time we're going to go all go eat. Come on, I'm paying. And she'd bring everybody from the bar over there to the restaurant to eat. Well, she did that innumerable times. Well, that helped us get on our feet. Because once people ate there and they liked the food, then they would start coming back just on their own. But she did that a lot.
This was not the only time Alice took it upon herself to help out a fellow business owner. Far from it. Here's Diane DiMaselli.
A lot of bar owners would go to other bars. And in those days, they would just say, set up the bar or set up the house. Okay. They buy everybody drinks. Okay. So she came to my bar one night and she was like, set up the bar. Well, she did this several times and she said, you know, run me a tab. So, okay. At the end of the night, I'm thinking, oh, wow, I'm going to have a great night, you know, because the bar was had a lot of people in it. So when I handed her the bill, she took the bill and tore it up in pieces. And she said, let that be a lesson to you. Never let people run a tab. I don't care how close they are to you. Don't run tabs for people. If they don't have money, loan them money out of your pocket. But don't run tabs. It was a very valuable lesson and a very smart lesson that a wise person would teach someone that they cared about and loved, because if you run a tab for somebody and they can't afford to pay you the tab back, then you're also going to lose their business and anybody else's business that they hang with. So I think what she taught me was very important, and I appreciated it very much. Of course, I was, you know, sitting there with my mouth hanging open, but it was a lesson. And, you know, in life, if you're fortunate enough to have someone like an Alice Brady who takes you under her wing, so to speak, and cares about you and shares all the knowledge they have with you, you're a very lucky person and a very loved person.
It seems Alice had a habit of taking people under her wing, particularly younger members of the gay community, like Dennis Sickles, who passed away a few years after Alice in 2014.
Alice, she practically raised Dennis, sent him Father's Day cards and all this and that.
This is Randy Elwood, Dennis's surviving partner.
And so I got to know Alice through Dennis through the years. She was a dear friend, great person.
Dennis was a teenager when he first crossed paths with Alice Brady.
She was kind of a fatherly example for him. She called him son, and, you know, she just looked after him. She let him have fun, but she kind of kept him on a choker chain a little bit. You know, if he got too far, she'd yank, you know. He was typical rowdy, you know, teenager. And she had his mother's phone number. And if he'd get a little too rowdy, she'd tell him she was going to call his mother. See, you know, she had no children, but she was real. She would find out what kind of food I'd like. And then when I'd be in town, but she'd find someplace and make it special, you know. But she did that with Dennis. One time give Dennis a El Camino because he was starting into the construction business.
This totally tracks with what I've heard about Alice. She literally once bought her nephew Riley a horse. It was not unusual at all for her to be buying a car for a loved one.
She used to have the car dealerships on speed dial. And you know, and if somebody needed help, she'd buy them a car. She was noted for buying, you know, three or four a year like that. And as well as helping people through school and so forth.
It's not that Alice ever had a lot of money lying around. Sure, her businesses were successful.
It seemed that, from what I was told, Alice had a real knack for making it, maybe not the best knack for keeping it.
In so many ways, Alice put everything into helping the people in her circles. And then, as she got older, the tables turned. Have you heard of Olivia, the travel company for lesbians and LGBTQ plus women? You know what they say. Life is short and the world is wide. And when you're a lesbian or LGBTQ plus woman, you want to be able to go on an adventure, have some fun, and be your unique self. Olivia Travel creates full takeovers of their cruise, resort, riverboat, and adventure vacations so you can zipline or scuba dive knowing you're with your own community. Discover Olivia for yourself at olivia.com or through the link in our show notes. Save $100 on your next Olivia booking with promo code CRUISING.
She had diabetes. It was getting harder for her to stand all day.
It was around 1976, 77, and at the time, Alice and her then-partner Ellen had been running the bar together.
For a little while, she just said, would you just manage the place for me? And I said, yeah. Now, she was there, but I was the one, you know, managing it. She was getting so she was thinking about retiring. She said, you know, I'm getting tired. And she said, I'm really having trouble adapting to this music. And that's strange because she liked all kinds of music. I can't get into this music and it's driving me nuts. Well, that was your disco music. And she said, I really think I'm going to retire or whatever.
But the question was, who should take over the bar?
We talked about it so many times. She had a bartender named Eddie Barrett that had been with her for quite a while. And Charlene Snyder was in there every day. Had been friends with Brady for a long time. She said, I think I'm going to give the bar to Eddie Barrett and Charlene. She said, yeah, I really think I'm going to do that. You know, they've been with me all these years and they're my friends and everything. And maybe it'll help them get on, really get on their feet.
You might remember Charlene from our episode earlier this season about her bar, Charlene's. And if you listened to that episode, you already know that Charlene didn't take over Alice Brady's. She opened her bar in December of 1977.
Well, don't you know about that time Charlene decided she was going to open a bar where she could have this and she was going to have that. And so she opened Charlene's on Elysian Fields, unbeknownst to Charlene that she was about to get Brady's for free.
So I'd never heard anything about this, but according to Ellen, there's a reason for that.
Very few people know this story because I just didn't want it known. So then when Charlene opened, it really kind of hurt Brady's feelings because it was like, I'm going to show you. You won't listen to anything that I want in here or whatever. It was that attitude that she gave to Brady, which really hurt me because it really hurt Brady. It really hurt Brady's soul because she'd been so good to Charlene for so many years, you know?
Of course, we'll never know exactly what went down between Alice Brady and Charlene. We've heard from others that Charlene had wanted to open a bar for a while and that the timing of her finally being able to do so had to do with her being laid off from her job at the local paper and receiving a sizable severance. We've also heard that Charlene had a different vision for her bar than Alice had. Charlene wanted a place for activism, and Brady had a strict no politics at the bar rule. But in any case,
Charlene's opened and was a success because, again, a little bit bigger than the present Brady's. And right off the bat, she started having live music. The first couple months that it was open, it hurt Alice's business, you know, because that's just the way in New Orleans that it was. Everybody would rush to the new bar. And so Brady decided, oh, what the hell, I think I'm going to just go ahead and retire. And that's when Diane Demaselli bought Brady's, and it became Diane's.
A little more background on Diane. She would go on to found New Orleans' only lesbian Mardi Gras crew, the Crew of Ishtar, in 1980. But in the late 70s, she was looking to get into the bar business.
I had a little corner grocery store. And Alice Brady knew that I was interested in buying a bar. So she called me up. She asked me to come meet her on a Sunday. And I did. And she told me how much money she wanted. She said, that's it. That's what I want. And there was no bargaining.
So in 1978, Diane bought out Alice Brady.
She knew me personally. And I think she felt like I was a person also of character and personality, and she respected that. She respected genuine people.
She had a couple people who had been asking her, and she just liked Diane. You know, Diane's got a good head on her shoulders and knows all the same people, and that's why. She liked her, and she decided that it would go on basically the same, which it did. You know, it did.
But retirement didn't exactly suit Alice Brady.
Well, Brady got really, really depressed. You can imagine she is now 60s, late 60s, maybe. All she had known for all these years was the bar business and being out every night and then to suddenly go to where you have nothing to do. So she'd sit in the chair and she just kept getting more and more depressed. And our relationship really took a toll on that.
She didn't do anything much for a while, and then she went back and worked in bars, a couple of bars herself, tending bar. So I think she kind of missed the life, you know, because that's what she did.
Alice actually bought out Charlene's original business partner and worked there for a while.
It got Brady back into the bar business, and it got her over that depression. And we actually broke up as partners, but we stayed close. They had T-shirts made and everything, and you know that said Brady's back, you know, and on the back of the shirt was Alice Brady. And she stayed at Charlene's for a good while.
But eventually, Alice needed to retire from the bar business for real.
Well, she was a bad diabetic, and of course she didn't pay any attention to it. You know, she had high blood pressure, and she just got weak to the point where she couldn't last a whole shift working behind a bar.
Remember Alice's old friend, Torchy? Well, at this point in time, Alice was living in Torchy's house with their other friend, Jackie, and Alice's poodle, an older rescue named Colette. Torchy had passed away in 1997, leaving the house to Alice and Jackie.
It was a 40s bungalow, and she liked her little home. You know, she had a ton of friends, and they were always coming over, and she'd name off different ones when we'd be there. You know, she seen this and this when they came over, they went to dinner, you know, or a celebration for different people, birthday parties, things like that. She had her little dog, and she and Jackie were close, and they were very good to each other, looked after each other.
But this is Alice Brady we're talking about.
Alice was happier when she was doing something.
She had to be in the what I call the action, you know.
She still had gifts to give, you know, knowledge, gifts. She still had mentoring to be able to do to other people. And it wasn't if you were running the bar. It was, you know, a lot of things.
This is Cindy.
Let's see. I met Alice in 1999 when she became a customer of my company as we supplied her with some of her medical supplies.
Cindy was the owner of a diabetic supply company. She was 41 when they first met. Alice would have been around 72.
I'll never, ever forget when I first met Alice. She called in and I said, oh, this is what we do. And, you know, we ship to you. And she says, oh, no, I'm coming to get it. Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay. So she came in and she got her supplies and she walked with cane. So she turned around. She had her bag and she turned around to go out the door. And she stopped. She had the door halfway open and she shook her cane at me and she said, this business is going to work. And I was a struggling business owner. And I said, well, I'm glad you have a lot of faith because I'm not so sure at times.
Alice couldn't have really known, but perhaps she sensed that this was exactly what Cindy needed to hear at the time.
I had finished a divorce and needed to get my daughter through school. And I was a single mom and, you know, I thought I'd try this company and I needed that confidence. And that's what she did for us. And that's what she did to people. She always made people feel good about themselves. She had an instinct ability to be able to do that. She saw my company as a new company, a young company just starting out. And she had all the faith in the world. And she gave me so much confidence. And I'll just never, ever forget that.
Alice couldn't resist the opportunity to help out yet another small business.
I could see, you know, that she was looking for something to keep herself occupied and her mind was very sharp. She'd come into the office to get her supplies and told me if ever I needed help, she'd come in and stuff envelopes or, you know, whatever we needed done.
So she came out of retirement once again and started working part-time for Cindy, mostly stuffing envelopes and giving business advice.
She didn't have, you know, no formal education in business, but Alice was shrewd with business. You know, how to do this or group these orders up or, you know, get a better price here. And so this gal picked up on that. And so Alice would go down there and she'd work. My gut feeling is less than 20 hours a week when she felt like it. She enjoyed it. And the pocket money was good, you know, although she gave most of it away to other people. You know, that was her nature.
She had got such a kick out of working with our patients because she was a patient and she had a lot of empathy towards people. And she could, you know, bring that empathy over to the other people. And they loved listening to her. And we loved listening to her in the office as she had her conversations because she spoke a little loud. So everybody in the office could hear her and we'd all giggle because she just loved speaking with people. She was a people person. You could quickly see that she was a really special person who had a strong instinct of people's characters. And I guess that came from her many years of running bars in her life.
For a while, Cindy had no idea that Alice Brady was essentially a celebrity to the New Orleans gay community.
It happened over many years, and just little by little would come out. And she'd just tell me a little bit here, a little bit there. And then, you know, I have a couple of friends that are gay, and then they told me, Alice Brady, Alice Brady. And I'm like, I got this old lady. What are you talking about? I got this old customer. This old lady's a customer. And she wants to come lick envelopes. I mean, for goodness sakes, what are we doing here? And just little by little, she began to tell me more and more. And I was like, what? And I look at her. I said, Alice, what is going on? And she just giggled. You know, she just giggled because it was her own thoughts and it was her own history. And she told me, she said, I put that part of my life aside. That was my life. And she kind of put that aside and she just wanted peace in her golden years. And that was where she was at when we met.
In these golden years, Alice and Cindy became very close.
We just had a very special friendship of businesswoman to businesswoman, even though we were in totally different businesses, healthcare versus drinks, the bar business. And Alice was a big component, a big part of our success because I had never run a company before and she gave me the confidence and some insight into how you run a company and serve people. And she served people for years in a different type of business, but it was still a business. It was still customer service. And so she shared that skill set with us.
And Alice seemingly got a lot out of this relationship as well.
And she felt very rewarded by being still having a place in society, still having a place in the workplace, and feeling like she was still helping and giving back to others. And that really is the summary of Alice Brady.
She kept this up for over a decade. But by 2010, 2011, Alice no longer had the energy to come into the office and work with Cindy. And this time, she wouldn't come back out of retirement.
She was very slow. It was very hard for her to get up. Her body was just weakening, I guess, and a little achy. And so it was difficult to get up, difficult to walk. Of course, she was very heavy. So it was just very difficult for her to get around. But then, you know, she just spent more and more time in her chair.
She held on for a long time. But see, the last year or so of her life, you know, she just was not well. It was getting worse and worse. The diabetes was bad and her heart was bad. She was having a lot of swelling. And of course, I'm no doctor, but really, things were just shutting down on her. You know, I think sometimes you get to a certain age, you know, that your organs just start heading south, you know. And when she was home, she was pretty limited on what she could do. You know, but a lot of gals came to see her and they brought her, you know, food and things like that. And, you know, they'd sit down and have meals with her and all that. She was truly blessed. When she got in that bad of shape, all her friends tried to make it as good for her as they could.
And then in February of 2012, Alice decided she was done fighting.
It was her breathing, her lungs, her breathing, and all up in here. And I'll never forget it. She called me Mardi Gras Day. She was in the hospital. And she called me Mardi Gras Day and she said, I'm done. I'm over. I don't want any more medicine. I don't want the doctor to do anything else. I've told the doctor, you know, kind of let the fluid build up and let me go.
So she went into hospice and Cindy says Alice gave her some marching orders.
She had me bring all of her CDs to the doctor, her male doctor, whom they used to love talking about music. So I went and brought all of the boxes of CDs to Dr. Goldman. And he said, what's this? I said, this is from Alice. And he was like, okay.
It seems Alice's generous nature had not gone away with her health.
Well, of course, I gave her a little paycheck, and she had gone and bought a car. And she said, I want you to have the car. She says, you bought the car. You've been paying me. You bought the car. I want you to have the car. I said, okay, I'll take the car. And she says, I want you to take the car and go deliver shoes to people who need their shoes, because we sold shoes to people. And I said, okay. So we would go. And everybody who worked at the company loved her. And so they took great pride in servicing the patients with Miss Alice's car. So that was the way that we kept her legend going.
Alice spent only a few days in hospice before she passed on February 25th, 2012.
Alice wanted to be with a couple of people when she died. So my daughter and I and Riley and, his wife we were there with her.
If you remember, Riley is Alice's nephew, whom she was always very close with.
She was pretty out of it, just kind of very groggy. So we would just talk to her and tell her things and tell her stories, and, because your hearing is the last thing to go. And we just tried to keep her, engaged, knowing that there were people around. She wasn't alone, because she didn't like to be alone. She liked to be around people. We were talking to her and rubbing her neck and her arms and letting her know that we were all there. She died surrounded by people, and that's the way she would have wanted to go. We were talking to her, and she took her last breaths, so she was comfortable.
I wish this could be the part of the episode where all of Alice's loved ones speak about their last moments with her, and we wrap everything up nostalgically and concisely. But like a lot of deaths, Alice's passing isn't that simple. The peaceful end surrounded by family that Cindy describes isn't how everyone remembers it.
The end was kind of not a pretty sight, but not too many people know that, except the ones of us that were going there. And by that time, Brady wasn't really aware of what was going on. It should have ended with every one of us that was like in that little group being right there, but it didn't.
A number of Alice's friends and family have shared with me that towards the end of her life, they were told she didn't want to see them.
It was totally out of character for Alice, and then for all within, the last 90 days to be completely different.
Somebody came in and kind of took over and wouldn't allow all of Alice's friends to really see her and stuff. She can't have company right now. She's too weak. She's too sick. She's too that.
When I first talked to Cindy, she didn't mention any of this. As you just heard, she initially referred to the end of Alice's life as surrounded by people. She said that's the way Alice wanted to go. But in a follow-up interview, when I probed about what Ellen and Randy and others had said, Cindy quickly changed her tune.
Well, I mean, listen, I think they're creating a lot of drama unnecessarily. She went into hospice. She did not want a whole lot of ruckus going on. She only wanted to see a few people. And, that was not the time for a bunch of people to be coming in crying over her bed. And she didn't want that. I just know that she had told me she did a lot for him, and they only wanted money. They only want to show up to get what they want, thinking that they're going to get stuff. And she didn't want to be bothered with any of that. I don't blame her. And so near the end, she became guarded and just wanted, a couple of people with her.
There's no way to know what exactly happened at Alice's bedside or whether or not Alice herself was the driving force behind the surprising cutoff from the rest of her friends and family. It's not like Alice had much to her name for anyone to really squabble over. She died in credit card debt, and Torchy's house went to Jackie, the last surviving roommate. Her car was really the only thing worth anything of value.
I think Dennis was going to get her a little car. What it was going to do was to pay some expenses that she'd had in the last, you know, few months, you know, but he didn't care, but he was going to sell the car for the funeral. She had a funeral deal and we handled all that.
Randy didn't know what had become of Alice's car, but of course, at this point, we do. Again, we really can't know for sure if all of this stems from changes of heart on Alice's end or something more sinister.
It's also something that you never really could prove. We were all too heartbroken from the loss of Brady to begin with, and it's just kind of a shame, you know, but that is what happened. We all vowed between each other that we know, and I'm pretty sure that she knows we know, but nothing ever came of it.
We've all moved on, but, you know, there was no doubt there was bad blood, and in my opinion, Riley was not treated fairly in his life. They did not get the respect that was due them because they were family. And it seemed like this bunch just forgot that. She loved Riley and Lois.
When I spoke with Riley about the end of Alice's life, it was clear he was still pretty hung up on the way all of this went down. He and Lois had been told over and over that Alice couldn't have any visitors, until finally he decided he didn't care. He was going to see Aunt Alice anyways. When Riley and Lois got to the hospice, the staff there was unaware Alice had any next of kin at all. Another confusing and out-of-character discovery.
Alice was, she was confused. You could tell, you know, she really was pretty bad off. Alice knew, though, at the very end, she told Riley that you know, maybe there were some mistakes made.
Riley told me this story, too. He said when they got there, Alice asked to talk with him and Lois alone, and that's when she confessed she'd made some mistakes. According to Riley, she asked them something like, "I never had to buy your love, right?" Riley and Lois assured her they didn't care about any of that. They were just glad they'd made it there to say goodbye.
He held her hand as she passed. It was a sad day. Somebody as wonderful as Alice, you never want to give, you know they're going to a better place, but you're not ready to give them up anyway, you know?
I've done a lot of research into the end of Alice's life in an attempt to figure out what really happened between her and Cindy and the rest of her loved ones. We've made the choice not to get into the nitty-gritty details, not just because they're inconclusive, but also because that's not what Alice should be remembered for. Even if Alice had grown tired of her own relationships and generosity as she faced death, that is so far from who she was in life.
I used to tell her she was like a turtle. She had a hard shell, you know, and we'd laugh. But she was such a kind-hearted person inside, you know. You wasn't going to take advantage of her. You just could forget that. You know, I've seen people try, and they didn't get very far. At the end, she might have let her guard down a little bit too much, but she was such a caring person. A lot of people, you know, rationally, well, I can only give so much. Alice gave whatever needed to be given.
She was genuine. She wasn't a hypocrite. She wasn't a phony. She wasn't out to just get your money. You know, she genuinely cared about the people that she liked and got close to. And she cared about everybody. But I mean, if you were someone she was close to, she would do anything for you.
Cruising is independently reported and produced by a small but mighty team of three. Story producer and social media manager Rachel Karp, line producer and resident road trip driver Jen McGinnity, and story producer and audio engineer me, Sarah Gabrielli. Our theme song is by Joey Freeman. This episode was sponsored by Olivia Travel. You can find us at our website, cruisingpod.com, on social media at cruisingpod, and at patreon.com/cruisingpod. Listen to Cruising wherever you get your podcasts.